October 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, 7 days to go before the presidential election as President Trump and Joe Biden make their final pitch to voters.
You look what I've done, we've all done together for this time.
We can build back better with an economy that rewards work, not wealth.
What scientists are saying about what a COVID-19 vaccine will and will not do. Also ahead, they met as judges on a singing competition. Now a country star and a pop singer say they're in it for life. It's all on today's International Edition. With 1 week to go before the presidential election, President Trump and Joe Biden are making their final arguments to voters, but in very different ways. Biden on Tuesday held a drive-in rally in Atlanta, Georgia, where he spoke to a crowd of supporters in honking cars.
Donald Trump crashed the economy that Barack and I left him. Like everything else he's left and inherited, he squandered it. We can build back better with an economy that rewards work, not wealth. We can do it without raising taxes on the middle class, I guarantee you.
Before Biden took the stage, the crowd was warmed up by hip-hop performers Common and Offset. Meanwhile, President Trump has been campaigning in Michigan, Nebraska, and the critical state of Wisconsin, where he held a big rally in West Salem that drew a large crowd of cheering supporters.
7 days from now, we are going to win this state, and we are going to 4 more incredible years in the White House.
The president's visit to Wisconsin came hours after state public health officials announced new record highs in coronavirus cases and deaths. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Wisconsin's chief medical examiner, Dr. Ryan Westergaard, says the previous records were set just about a week ago.
It's a nightmare scenario, frankly, that this could get quite a bit worse in the next several weeks or months before it gets better.
Health Secretary Designee Andrea Palm says significant action needs to be taken.
We all need to stay home. Do not interact with people that you do not live with.
Several months ago, the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down Governor Tony Evers' formal stay-at-home order.
If people stay at home, we can call it whatever. I call it saving lives.
Evers is pleading with people in Wisconsin to voluntarily shelter in place. I'm Ed Donahue.
Nearly a 500,000 people in the United States have contracted the novel coronavirus in the last 7 days as cases and hospitalizations set records in hotspots in the Midwest. More than 5,600 people have died from the virus nationwide in the last week, with hospitalizations shooting up 13%. In Europe, the picture is unrelentingly grim as a string of countries reported record increases led by France. Well, citizens around the world are weary from months of social distancing and shutdowns due to the pandemic. A handful of companies are in late-stage trials to develop a safe and effective vaccine against COVID-19, with talk of manufacturers potentially applying for emergency use authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. If that were to happen, it will not mean things go back to normal. Joining us now to understand what it would mean to have vaccines in the late testing stage given emergency approval is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Thank you so much for being with us. So what is your view on this? And if it happens, can those receiving a vaccine under emergency approval be assured it's safe?
We all want a vaccine soon. A vaccine would help prevent deaths. By the way, it's not clear it would stop people from infecting one another, but certainly it would be important to have something that would prevent people from getting sick. And so some of the early vaccine contenders, Pfizer's vaccine, Moderna's vaccine, there's hope that if you look at the data that they are collecting now on safety and on efficacy, it'll be strong enough that they don't have to wait till the end of their studies, which might be, probably not until next spring, to say the data looks good and we're going to seek an emergency use authorization from the FDA. That would have something maybe start to become available by December or January. And everybody, I think, can take some confidence in the fact that the data determination about being safe enough and good enough is done by an independent committee, not connected, if you will, to making money off the vaccine. They would just look at the data at the two-thirds point and say, it looks so good that we think it ought to be made available on an emergency use basis. The FDA would then look at that data and make a decision about whether it agreed and then allow it for use in the U.S. And if it becomes available in the U.S., there may be some availability in other countries, too. People may be able to buy it. Not that it's going to be in abundant supply. Emergency use is probably going to be with a relatively scarce amount of vaccine initially because you still have to ship it, get it out to places. The Moderna vaccine, for example, is a two-shot vaccine that requires a lot of refrigeration. So it wouldn't be available to everybody in the U.S. or even to some people overseas right away. But I think what they're thinking is maybe get it to healthcare workers, maybe get it to nursing home residents who are at the greatest risk of death.
So any decision to have something like this available at the three-quarter mark would be not only, as you said, reviewed by experts, but would it not be under any political influence?
Well, the FDA has certainly been pushed by the White House to try and hurry up the approval of vaccines. But there's nothing that the FDA can do. It's up to the manufacturers to decide when they think they have enough data to bring it to the FDA. So there's politics, but I think the FDA has made it clear it can't do anything and it won't do anything to push the manufacturers. The manufacturers of vaccines, the Pfizers and the Modernas and the Johnson & Johnson, I think they have concerns about legal liability if they put something out there that was unsafe. And I think they'd worry about their reputation. They put something out that didn't work. So I'm not so worried about politics. But here's what does worry me. If you get an emergency use approval, then people in the studies, we're in them now, I think they're going to want to say, well, I'm in the study, but I would like to get first access to that now available vaccine. After all, I volunteered and was courageous and signed up for a study. If they did that, it would harm the study because they would be dropping out. You'd have to tell them whether they got placebo or the experimental vaccine, and then they'd try to somehow make a program to make it available to them as well as to the healthcare workers and the nursing home residents. If that happened, then we wouldn't get the completed study because it would be undermined or damaged as people dropped out. I don't see any way to avoid it, though. Every human subject has a right to know if something important happens to reconsent, and getting an emergency use approval would be important. So it could generate up a problem. Good news, the study looks strong at three-quarters of the way or two-thirds of the way. Bad news, we can't finish the study because we had to tell everybody in it whether they were on placebo or not, and some of them left and went to try and get the vaccine.
Let's talk a little bit about where we are right now with the pandemic. Where do you see us between now and the first few months of the new year? We are hearing a lot of worrisome reports.
I'm worried about where we are now because I think we're going to go into a very challenging period of more cases and more deaths, more hospitalization. And the reason I say that is cold weather in the northern hemisphere, Europe, USA, Canada, means more people indoors, more close contact, more pressure on the number of people trying to get into a restaurant or a bar or any place in groups. We still see our politicians, particularly Trump, holding mass rallies. That's bad. He may be spreading the infection right now, which will come back to haunt us in a couple of months. And Europe, despite efforts in many countries to have sort of controlled shutdowns, they opened up pretty quickly in the summer, and they look already like they're in the middle of a second wave of the pandemic. So I think we're in for a rough ride this winter.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Thanks for being with us. Britain and the European Union are in the midst of closed-door negotiations over their future relationship following the so-called Brexit earlier this year when the UK left the European Union. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Henry Ridgewell in London to understand what these negotiations are about.
This is all about the future relationship between Britain and the European Union. Britain left the European Union on January 31st this year. It's had this year as a transition period. That comes to an end on December the 31st. During that time, they're supposed to have negotiated a new trade deal, which will dictate the future relationship between the two sides. But the trouble is, of course, coronavirus has thrown everything into disarray. The face-to-face negotiations came to an end in March, and they've only recently resumed over the summer. But there are also sticking points within the negotiations themselves about what that future trading relationship is going to look like. One of the major ones is on state aid. How much should the British government and how much should Europe be allowed to support domestic firms? Another sticking point has been who referees this? Who's the umpire for all these rules? And thirdly, there's fish. Now, Britain, of course, is an island. It's a coastal state. It's got rich fishing waters. And as it has been a member of the European Union, any other European Union member, fishing boats have been able to come to British waters and catch their fish. But now that Britain is leaving, it wants to control its own sovereign waters. And it's using that really as leverage against Europe and saying we're going to stop European boats coming to catch fish in our waters. So those are the three major sticking points. There's one other that's worth noting as well, the Irish border issue. Britain being accused of breaking international law by threatening to go against the withdrawal agreement, which is all about whether there's going to be a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And that's really angered some European Union members, particularly Dublin, of course.
Now, is there a deadline for these negotiations?
I think the hard deadline really is mid-November, because it's going to take at least the 4 or 6 weeks that remain of the year after that to ratify any trade agreement, both in Britain and in the European Union. And if it's a detailed agreement, it will have to be ratified by each member state as well, the other 27 EU members. So there's still a lot of complexities to get over. So I think that's the deadline that all the negotiators have in their minds.
Of course, all of this is happening right before the U.S. election, and the U.S. is a very close trade partner of both the U.K. and the European Union. How does the U.S. election factor into these negotiations?
Well, it's being watched very carefully here in London because, of course, President Trump supported Brexit. We know that Boris Johnson and Donald Trump have built up a good relationship since Boris Johnson became leader last year, and Donald Trump has spoken warmly of a trade deal between the United States and post-Brexit Britain. And so this was all part of the game plan of the British government. If Donald Trump is re-elected, then we can expect more warm words, I think, across the Atlantic between Britain and America towards that trade deal, and perhaps priority given to that trade deal over any other potential trade agreements for the time being. If Joe Biden wins, that presents a potential difficulty for Britain because he has strong links to the American Irish community. Indeed, his family traces back to the Republic of Ireland, and they have voiced anger at Britain's move to possibly renege on the withdrawal agreement and Britain's negotiations over that Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border. And Joe Biden has said that, you know, any attempt to put a hard border up there, or if any of Britain's actions would put peace in Northern Ireland at risk since that Good Friday Agreement was agreed in 1998, then there would be no chance of a trade agreement between the United States and Britain. But we do know that the British government has been making overtures to the Joe Biden camp in the last few weeks. And of course, there is always a warm relationship between Britain and America. I don't think we would see any hard words between Washington and London if Joe Biden was elected as president, but it potentially would be more tricky.
Journalist Henry Ridgewell in London speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Residents of South Africa, for the most part, say 4 years of U.S.-Africa relations under President Donald Trump have done nothing for their lives. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to analysts and citizens in Johannesburg, the economic hub of the continent, about what matters to them as America votes.
South Africa, Africa's most mature democracy, is watching the American election with great interest and trepidation. VOA has, during the past 4 years, spoken to hundreds of South Africans of all backgrounds about U.S. politics and found few who openly support President Donald Trump. Most pin their disapproval on reports that he made disparaging comments about African nations. On the streets of Johannesburg, entrepreneur Katiala Maine says he's pulling for former Vice President Joe Biden. Here's what he thinks of the current president.
He wants to make America great again, but America needs the rest of the world in order for it to be great. The fact that he believes that disinvestment or lesser aid to African countries is warranted. Well, that's his opinion.
Others, like technical support worker Itumeleng Mofokeng, say they pine for the past and try to ignore the deluge of news.
Personally, I'm so all for Barack Obama. I wish America could do the right things and bring back Barack Obama. I'm not feeling who's our new president? Donald Trump. Personally, no, he's not my favorite.
American diplomat turned journalist Brooke Spector, who has lived in South Africa since the 1970s, says South Africans' fascination with the U.S. is understandable.
It's a kind of mirror image of their own society, with a lot of the same prickly bits and wounds, but phrased or framed in a different kind of way, so that they see, and Americans see this too, obviously, race relations in the United States is a topic of surpassing importance to the American society, history, politics, life, religion, the whole thing.
The most important policy aspect, he says, is the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which expires in 2025. The act allowed South Africa to export $8.55 billion worth of goods duty-free to the U.S. in 2018. But some South Africans, like photographer Ezra Kwaunu, say they are indifferent to the world's largest economy.
Donald Trump and his policy in Africa, I actually don't know what his policy in Africa is, but like, I actually don't care for what's happening in America at all, to be honest.
Africa's not come up often on the campaign trail, but Trump's periodic tweets about the continent, from his concerns about killings of white farmers in South Africa to more recent comments about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, have sparked criticisms from African leaders. Biden has also seldom brought up the continent, but counts former Obama-era policy experts on his campaign team, a sign he may seek to restore the previous administration's Africa policy. This election may be unfolding on the other side of the world, South Africans say, but the result could affect their lives too, and they are watching. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
India and the United States have signed a landmark agreement to share military information and pledged to ramp up security and strategic ties during a visit by top U.S. officials to India. As Anjaya Pashrika reports, New Delhi was the first stop on a four-nation Asia tour to shore up American partnerships to confront Chinese assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific region.
After talks between top Indian and American officials in New Delhi on Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo referred to the threat from the Chinese ruling Communist Party.
Our leaders and our citizens see with increasing clarity that the CCP is no friend to democracy, the rule of law, transparency, nor to freedom of navigation, the foundation of a free and open and prosperous Indo-Pacific.
Pompeo, along with Defense Secretary Mark Esper, were in New Delhi for an annual meeting known as the 2+2 Ministerial Dialogue, held with the Indian Foreign and Defense Ministers. The two countries signed a landmark agreement that will give India access to topographical and aeronautical data considered vital for targeting missiles and armed drones. It is the last of four pacts that the countries have sealed in recent years, setting the stage for significantly bolstering their military and strategic partnership. Both sides sounded an upbeat note about their growing ties. Although Indian officials did not directly refer to China, Indian Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar called the movement of the relationship with Washington exceptionally positive. Defense Secretary Esper emphasized their growing cooperation in the region.
Based on our shared values and common interests, we stand shoulder to shoulder in support of a free and open Indo-Pacific for all, particularly in light of increasing aggression and destabilizing activities by China.
The talks were held as India remains locked in a months-long military standoff with Beijing on its Himalayan borders, and concerns grow in Washington about China flexing its muscles in the Indo-Pacific region. Before heading into the talks, the U.S. officials paid tribute to Indian troops at a war memorial, including 20 soldiers who died earlier this year in an incident with China. According to Pompeo,
the United States will stand with the people of India as they confront threats to their sovereignty and to their liberty.
In Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin dismissed U.S. accusations about its assertiveness. He said China urges Pompeo to abandon the Cold War and the zero-sum game mentality and stop sowing discord between China and regional countries, as well as undermining the regional peace and stability. Delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic, the India-US dialogue was held just 1 week before the US elections. Analysts point out that there is wide political consensus in both countries about the need to shore up their partnership amid mutual worries about China. The talks between the two countries affected by the pandemic also focused on cooperation in vaccines that are under development and testing that are seen as key measures to control the rampaging infection. From India, Pompeo travels to Sri Lanka, the Maldives, and Indonesia in a bid to bolster allies in the Indo-Pacific, all strategically located countries that Washington hopes can play a role in pushing back against Beijing. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A new analysis of the humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen finds levels of acute malnutrition among children under the age of five are soaring, putting tens of thousands of lives at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A new analysis of the humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen finds levels of acute malnutrition among children under age five are soaring, putting tens of thousands of lives at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. A survey of 133 districts in southern Yemen finds more than 500,000 children, about one in five, are suffering from acute malnutrition. Spokeswoman for the UN Children's Fund, Marixi Mercado, notes this is a 10% increase since January and the highest number ever recorded in this region since the Yemen civil war began in 2015.
The most significant increase is among young children who suffer from severe acute malnutrition. This is a condition that leaves children around 10 times more likely to die of diseases such as cholera and diarrhea, malaria, or acute respiratory infections, all of which are common in Yemen. The new number released today is up 15.5% since January, for a total of at least 98,000 children.
Numbers for the remaining districts in northern Yemen are still being analyzed. UNICEF says the situation in these areas is expected to be similarly troubling based on historical trends. Jens Laerke, a spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, reports the United Nations is strapped for cash. He warns many of these at-risk children are likely to die if they are unable to get the treatment they urgently need to save their lives.
We have been warning for several months now that Yemen was heading towards a cliff. We are now seeing the first people falling off that cliff. Those are the children under 5 years of age. 100,000 of them are at risk of death, we are told. The world can help. The world can help by supporting the humanitarian response plan.
That plan is massively underfunded. Laerke notes only 42% of the UN's $3.2 billion appeal for this year has been received, and the year, he says, is nearly over. The report finds at least 250,000 pregnant or breastfeeding women also are in need of treatment for malnutrition. UN experts warn the actual number probably is higher as the conditions driving malnutrition in Yemen this year have worsened. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. Black films and TV series are receiving critical acclaim and have become box office sensations. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with film critics who say this new Black Renaissance shows audiences' appetite for thought-provoking, entertaining, and diverse stories is growing.
Ryan Coogler's 2018 superhero film, Black Panther, about a powerful African kingdom and its king, was one of the highest-grossing films of all time, raking in $1.3 billion internationally. The mega blockbuster with a predominantly black cast has prompted Hollywood to flood money on more black productions and TV series than ever before.
That woke everybody up and said, wow, there's money here. And suddenly, all of the black filmmakers who had ideas and passion and vision, suddenly now they had money. So they could actually make the movies that they wanted to make.
I waited my entire life for this.
Over the course of probably the last 10 years, we've seen a renaissance in black storytelling like we haven't seen probably in the first, I don't know, 90 years of storytelling in our community.
Critically acclaimed black films such as Barry Jenkins's Oscar-winning drama Moonlight or Ava DuVernay's documentary 13th have illuminated black life and offered cultural affirmation to black audiences, says Berardinelli.
A group of people who for so long did not see themselves reflected on screen now suddenly see themselves reflected on screen. And, you know, in the superhero movies, now you have your Black Panther, of course. But you also now have the new Captain America is black, Anthony Mackie.
Berardinelli says as they enter the American mainstream, black films are attracting a wider demographic.
Because the multiculturalism of the younger generation is much more varied than it is for the older generation.
You were formed by the heat of the galaxy. What a thing to be both unique and familiar.
Black women directors are also gaining support. Gordon says this year, 15 films are directed by black women alone. One of them is Beyoncé, who wrote, directed, and produced the visual album Black is King.
Lead.
The fusion of kind of like a Lion King theme mixed in with a Black Panther theme, I thought hit you squarely in the pride aspect.
As for criticisms leveled against Beyoncé that she misappropriated elements of African culture into her African American production,
it's hard to criticize a black person who is paying homage to her ancestors who are African in nature. So it wasn't even like she brought a bunch of Americans in to pretend to be from Mali or to pretend to be from Ghana or to pretend to be from South Africa. She used South Africans. She used folks from Mali. She used folks from Ghana. She used folks from the continent.
Gordon hopes to see more black films and black lead characters across all genres for all audiences.
True equality is when you are able to tell all these different stories and they are no longer looked at as niche films. They're just a part of the fabric of what makes America great.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And in music news, The Voice co-stars Blake Shelton and Gwen Stefani are engaged. The country star and pop singer met as judges on the singing competition show years ago. They began dating after Shelton divorced Miranda Lambert and Stefani divorced her husband, Gavin Rossdale, in 2015. The two have recorded duets together, including Nobody But You, which just won a CMT Music Award last week. Shelton and Stefani posted a picture Tuesday announcing the engagement. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us, and have a great day.